there some? Do you get that, Woods, that he's really loud?
No. Not
okay, it's just my phone. Okay, yeah. Go ahead, Scott.
You know, a question came to my mind. I was listening, reviewing last week's, your session from last week with Scott, and, you know, I got to thinking, if tactility is the interplay of the senses, how can you leave the dance? How can you leave dancing out of it? The kinetic movement of dancing to music. You know, I started thinking about the shamans in the Amazon doing ayahuasca, drumming, singing, dancing, and all of that coming together. How can you know? That feels like tactility. If you're going to talk about music as tactility, where people are, and you don't include dancing, then it seems like it's only an Android meme tactility.
Well, that was our opening quote, dancing architecture.
Yeah.
That's what we began with. I included dancing. But remember, tactility is the interplay between the nervous system and the skin. And the skin's all over the body, so the main tactile on the surface, main things are fingers and toes. And Theo writes about that in his books. Most people don't think of the toes as tactile, but definitely dancing is the rhythm of the interval. That's tactile.
Mm-hmm.
It's more kinetic, but the actual toe part, the toe part is the tactile.
Hmm.
The legs would be the kinetic, the muscles.
Right, but that would have to be part of the tactility too. How can you leave any of the senses out? Kinetic, you have kinetic senses. What do you call them, proprioceptive or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, proprioceptive is inside, and then there's kinetic. And
right.
And
yeah, so it's got to include all of that, right?
Yeah, but that's what the opening quote was. Remember, what was it, Scott? Dancing with
writing about music is like dancing about architecture. But
yeah.
I will say that, you know, that the subject of dancing, to Scott's point, I mean, it causes a lot of anxiety in rock criticism, I think.
Yeah, usually the writers are guys who can't dance.
Yeah, your point is well taken, because most rock critics don't have a clue about dancing. They don't dance, which is part of, you know, they don't dance as part of their criticism.
Yeah, they're observers. That's
Richard
what
Meltzer does. Meltzer does.
Right.
His writing is dancing.
Yes, and I always, I probably have a good sensibility for pop music because I was a great dancer. Still am. So, I mean, in my terms, I'm a good dancer. And so I always thought the musicians were the guys who couldn't dance.
Yeah.
They usually were the nerdy guys, you know.
Well, same with DJs, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
My wife often says to me, "Oh, you don't like to you know, we go to like a wedding. So how are you not into dancing? It's like because I want to be up there. I want to be the guy playing the records."
Yeah, you're a control freak.
With my fingertips, kind of thing. More, you know, more than out on the floor with everyone else or something.
Yeah, you're a control freak. You want to control the rhythms. Tetrad manager.
Yeah.
Tetrad manager there, but the dancing. Dancing is pop music. I mean, McLuhan used to point out that dancing was the main cultural form of American life. And it's been dancing, you know, when he wrote, for 80 years. You start off with the can-can or ragtime, whatever was at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Ragtime, can-can, then swing. Dancing. McLuhan says that pop music in America is geared toward dancing. That's what it's all about, dancing.
Yeah.
So go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, so dancing, when McLuhan saw as a hyperkinetic activity. Theo was interesting because he pointed out the tactility of the toes. But generally, McLuhan seemed to me saying that America was a kinetic visual culture and dancing was its relief mechanism, so dancing was its kinetic side. It's a kinetic kind of dancing, whereas European had the courtly dancing. You know, they're visually biased dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, in European courts, the waltz was a wild dance when it came in.
Yeah.
So there's a whole, you know, the aristocrats were tribal and ritual, and they had that whole mask dancing, you know, 300 years ago. And then it got loosened up with the Industrial Age with the waltz. That was barbarian, the waltz. And then America became nutty with the can-can or the ragtime, whatever came in with Scott Joplin, those guys. And then that fascinated the Europeans. So look at these wild Americans, you know. They hyper-danced.
If you bring, thinking about the tribal drumming, that brings the fingertips back in because, you know, you've got the tactile interval of the fingers hitting the drums.
Yeah, that's why McLuhan's phrase, audile-tactile, audio-tactile is a good phrase, because you're including the ear and the tactile in a tactile merger, so it's hard to tell where the tactility begins or leaves off in relation to individual senses. So, yeah, the fingers, the acoustic interval, the toe interval, the dancing, it's...
Now, I used to play guitar. Now, that you got your fingers, you got your fingertips on the on, but it's a different tactile.
That would be kinetic pressure.
Yeah,
using your fingers. But you know,
but, you're using your fingers and all. You're doing all these. Your fingers are dancing on the fretboard. You know, you're doing these. If you're playing lead guitar or even playing chord structures or whatever.
Yeah, well, the piano, McLuhan said, was a visual literate instrument. So your fingers are dancing on that, but it's visual, and then you're dancing on the guitar. It's the amplification, the electricity that changes everything.
Yeah.
And then that's the vibration that's appetizable, the bone conduction. The massage of electric media is...
You don't get feedback until you get the electric.
Right. It's the tactile is an interplay. Like Ben always reduces it to the dialectic. It's dialectical, yeah. But he thinks in oral visual terms of dialectic. But you got to include the kinetic and the proprioceptive. So, yep, there's a lot of tactility in music, electrifies American culture.
Do you, I forgot, Scott, do you play an instrument?
I have in the past. I mean, I used to do a lot of stuff in the studio with Dave Neufeld, but that was more... sort of production per se, rather than I was never anything like, you know, the sort of instrumentalist that Dave Neufeld was. I could write songs on guitar and stuff, like, you know, beginning of pop songs. I can kind of dabble a little bit on a lot of different things, but I'm not proficient at any particular instrument. I'm really good with a sampler,
making
other people's stuff and doing, you know, stuff with that. So
did you see the image? What
I'm on your album, by the way, Bob. I actually supplied David a couple samples for that album.
Of sound?
Yeah, just of some sound, yeah.
Yeah, remember, it's not my album.
Dave
Neufeld's album.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I'm on, so you and I are on Dave's album.
That's right. I constitute about 0.005% of the output.
Okay.
99%, yeah.
You weren't in his little band with Chuck that got on City TV.
Yes, I was, yeah.
Wow, we got footage of that on YouTube or something.
Yeah, that's on YouTube, yeah.
So that's you? You're on there?
Yeah, I'm on there with him. I'm in fact, it's quite funny because even Dave laughed about it. I like, you know, we're lip syncing, obviously, right?
Yeah.
They at one point they actually do a close up of my hands, and I'm totally flubbing the notes. It's so obvious. It's like it's just kind of quite hilarious.
Okay, let me look at it. What's it called?
It's Catch 22.
Yeah.
First, last, everything.
First, last, everything. Right.
It's pretty terrible that part, though. I mean, I think it's just, you know. Oh, you know who posted that? It was my brother posted that, actually.
Right.
He's the one who put that online.
I'll send it to Scott. Okay, I'm clicking on it. PXW13?
That's right, yeah. That's my brother, yeah.
Okay, so, I looked at it when your brother put it up about a year ago. I saw it. So we're now...
Dave's doing the phone thing, which is pretty cool.
Right. It was so Bob Club 22-ish.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're on the other piano.
Yeah.
And Chuck singing?
Yeah.
Look at these fanatic kids. Okay, so there's... Well, you look... Okay, give us a close-up of Scott. We'll see who we're dealing with here. Close-up, Buckface. Give me a close-up.
What is that, 20 years ago?
Oh, there you are. You kind of have a body like Neufeld.
Oh, people used to say we look like brothers.
Yeah, Around
that time, Dave and I used to hang out so often, and I mean, then we lived together for 5 years. That we would sometimes go to stores together, and you know, it'd be funny. It'd be some Asian woman, older Asian woman whose English wasn't great, and she, you know, Dave would make her laugh about something, and then they'd say, "You two brothers?
You brothers
or something?" Like we had that weird sort of connection.
Yeah, you can see that. So I'll send this to Scott. This is Dave. I mean, what happened is that Dave was just, this is like 87 or something, 88.
Yeah, 88 or 89.
Yeah, he did. This was where Dave was predestined, because he just was learning, just got the sampler, got kicked off CKLN, news director. So now he's playing with the sampler, just computer learning it. And some guy, hey, said, could you make something? And they did it, and it kind of became a local hit. And then you guys get on TV.
Well, what it was it was a song that was actually already a hit in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Like some English band or something. But it became, like, for some reason, the song went out of print, and it became absolutely impossible, like, possible to find. Like, you would literally, if you found a used 12-inch of it around that time, it would go for, like $150 or something. It was kind of really ridiculous. And I knew other DJs who actually confirmed that. It's like, oh, yeah, you could not get that single. Like, every DJ in the city wanted it. So this, you know, some enterprising guy with his own label was smart. It's like, oh, all these DJs are asking for this song. We should just remake it and try and mimic the original performance as close as possible. So they didn't want Dave to do anything original. They wanted him to, you know, here's the original recording. Just try and remake it, you know, as close as you possibly can.
Right.
And DJs will eat it up. And to some degree they did. I mean, it wasn't huge or anything, but, you know, I'm sure a lot of people did probably buy it specifically for that reason.
But we now have this footage of you on TV.
Yeah, we got us on Electric Circus.
Yeah, and so you're saying that for some reason it became a rarity because nobody could find it, because it was sort of popular at its time, and they said, let's have this come back for some reason.
Yeah, it was like, it was a big CFNY, sort of one of those, like, synth dance songs, and for whatever reason, it went out of print, and you could just not, you couldn't buy a copy anywhere, and DJs, you know, always kind of wanted a copy of it. That obviously was before the age of, you know, downloading or anything, so if you didn't have it, you'd be shit out of luck, so.
Okay, so, did I tell you guys last week about the synchronicity with the, Vincent Gallo movie Brown Bunny?
No.
I didn't tell you about this. Now, this is the way it is. Okay, so this is Bob Zanocrony. You know who Vincent Gallo is?
Yeah, I've heard about that movie, yeah.
Brown Bunny. And so I watched the one before that. No, Buffalo 66. I watched
Buffalo
that.
Buffalo 66. I've seen that one,
yeah. Yeah, then I watched Brown Bunny, and which is famous because at the end he gets his girlfriend to give him a blowjob at the end.
Right.
Okay, so, though there are rumors it's not a real penis. So, it's Buffalo 66. I'm watching it. It's all about the kid's mother being obsessed with, a subplot, obsessed with the Buffalo Bills losing a Super Bowl in 66 or something. And the guy who, he could have won it with his field kick, but he blew it.
Okay,
so I'm watching this, and then they show the footage, and it is Scott Woods. They show the footage, and Scott Woods goes to kick the fucking ball and blows it.
I think I remember that.
Now, here's the point. What's the point? Can you figure out the Zanocrony here?
Well, obviously, there's a relation between you in the movie and me somehow.
Yeah.
But what entity or what presence you appear as in the movie, I can't say. I can't remember the movie well enough, so.
Okay. Back in the 80s, when I would go on another DJ's show on CKLN, I would go on, I would get on because I said, I'm going to kill you. And they didn't know what I meant, but I said, I'd kill you. If you put me on there and we start talking, I will kill you. So they would put me on a little apprehensive or just considering it silly. And what always would happen, they'd be trying to figure out what the hell I've been talking about on Mike's show or any other thing I was on. And so there was a bit of mystery about what the hell's Bob mean. So we would talk about Bob's stuff. And I'd always, no matter what, give them some quirky eureka. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I was pretty good at explaining whatever it is that they couldn't get, and then I would explain it, and they'd get excited. Wow, I get it. And so right when they're cheering about how they got a new insight, I said, see, I killed you. I killed them. I killed their mind limitation and opened up into a new thing. Okay?
Yeah.
So that was what I was known for doing. I did it with several DJs, and it always worked. And everybody, when I pointed out that that's what I meant by killing people, I give them an insight, kill their old image of whatever they thought they knew, and they get it. They'd get it, and they'd be excited. So that was fun. So here it is. That movie, Buffalo 66, comes out in 97 or so. But I don't watch it until 12 years later. It just happened for some reason. It was that Beautiful Losers documentary that went into that art movement, which he was kind of associated with. So, and Harmony Korine did Gummo. So the Gallo and Harmony Korine are similar. Right. So, so I started watching the movie just to see what it is. And it's all about this guy, played by Vincent Gallo, who gets out of jail, and he's going to kill Scott Woods. Why? Because 5 years before, he had put a bet on Buffalo, $10,000, and it came down to a field goal. And I don't know if it's the one, I don't know if the mother is worrying about 66, because that's too early for the kid, or about the field goal would be maybe in the 90s, or something like that. So I didn't totally get that. The guy who actually blew it, you were looking in the Wikipedia, he was Scott Woods, very close, Scott Knightwood or something, very close to the name. So he gets out of jail. Fine. Okay, so Scott Woods fails to get the kick, Buffalo doesn't win, he's out $10,000. So it shows him with Mickey O'Rourke as a mafia guy who's going to kill him, but he makes a deal. He says, my buddy is up for a charge, I want you to claim that you did it, and you go spend the several years in jail, and that'll be the way you'll pay your debt to me. And so So Gallo agreed to that, goes to jail for 5 years, comes out really pissed off, and the first thing he's going to do is kill Scott Woods. So he finds out that he runs, now here's the music thing, he runs a nightclub sex club. And so he goes there, and he approaches Scott, the Scott Woods guy, who's just sitting there with three naked girls partying. And even though everybody hates him and he's known to be hated, he's still having a good time in the underworld, right? So he Gallo films shooting him, but then it turns out it was just a thought, and he didn't really shoot him. And then he decides not to shoot him, and he walks away, and he realizes, hey, that's neat. And then he gets in a good mood, and then he returns to his girlfriend, who is ambiguous, and it's a happy ending, okay? The point is, the only time Scott Woods has ever been that name ever in any movie, I bet. I don't think it's ever shown up ever before, right?
Not that I know of. Yeah.
We don't know of any characters in any of Hollywood that ever had Scott Woods. But there was one movie done 12 years ago. I get involved with Scott Woods. I'm going to intellectually kill him. This is what you were nervous about, this whole theory. And right when I'm doing that, the Android beam says, well, Bob, here's what you're talking about. And arranges for me to think about getting that movie. I watch it, not knowing what's in it. And there it is. Scott Woods getting killed, and I don't kill him. You know, happy ending.
That's brilliant.
Isn't that amazing?
Listen to this, Bob. This is from the Wikipedia page. This will even blow you even further. So the last part of the plot. The subplot of Billy seeking revenge on the man indirectly responsible for imprisonment, Scott Wood, so it's Scott Wood without an S.
Yeah.
The reference to former Buffalo Bills kicker Scott Norwood.
That's Scott Norris.
Scott Norris and Wood.
Holy cow, I didn't notice that. Man, that's fucking incredible. Now you tell me the Android meeting ain't working for me. That's Ripley's Believe It or Not material.
I just saw that. I'm like, what the?
I'm glad you looked it up. I forgot that.
Scott Norwood. That's fucking bizarre, man.
See, now you tell me the Android meme ain't talking and working for me. That's Duchamp was trying to do with found art. Well, you know, I find, what do you call it, pattern recognition, ESP within the media.
Oh, man.
What do you think of that, Scott Norris?
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's a good one.
You know, I just, you know, a while back we were trading movies, and you recommended one called Bring Me the Head of...
Alfredo Garcia.
Yeah.
1974, yeah.
And this is not directly connected, only peripherally connected to what we're talking about, but I never mentioned to you, there's a scene in, I'm sure you knew it, but I forgot to mention it to you, but there's a scene in there where the guy, one of the killer guys comes walking, yeah. main character comes walking through the door and surprises somebody who wants to know who it is, and he says, "I'm Dobbs."
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, there's a guy in there named Dobbs.
That was a good movie. I've not seen it, in, you know, since 1974. Maybe I watched it again in the 80s, but I missed that.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
So I got the link to the YouTube, and did you say Scott Woods is in here, or Dave Neufeld, or both of you guys?
Yeah, Neufeld's on the right, and Scott Woods is on the left. The singer in the between.
Yeah, okay.
He's someone talking on the phone.
Oh, you guys do look like you could be brothers. You got the same color hair, same haircut, same...
skinny bodies?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just looking at a profile of the two of you. This is within the first 30 seconds. Neufeld is sort of got it looking down at his keyboard, and he has a microphone in front of his mouth, and then I guess that's Scott Woods over there. So maybe if I watch some more, there's some more. Are you guys in there throughout this thing, or just in the very beginning where I see it now?
I think there's various shots throughout the whole thing.
I can't remember,
but I don't think there's too many more close-ups.
Oh, well, that looks like it was fun. Was this like a show like Dance Train or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was like they. You know, it'd be all like the dance hits of that week sort of thing.
Oh, my God.
They'd have like one or two bands on, and the rest would just be like a DJ sort of spinning the tunes. It was pure dance music, so.
Wow. And then you guys, that must have been fun to be part of a show like that. That's cool.
Yeah, it was very cool.
Huh. And this was a film, this was in Canada?
Yeah, it's in Toronto. It's the famous Much Music Moses Neimer Empire.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You could walk along the street, maybe not back then, but I know in the 90s you'd walk along the street and look at the whole dance studio TV broadcasting through the window. Right?
I think even then you could. Yeah,
okay.
So, Scott, now I'm looking at a scene where Neufeld is on the telephone.
That's right.
Yeah, that's Bob stuff. I mean, he had learned that your disc card on the phone.
Oh, wow.
And you actually think of it, one of the famous song by Arthur Lee of Love was The Red Telephone. I don't know if Dave thought of that. So he could, like Meltzer would have seen that as a quote from Arthur Lee.
That's right. Meltzer loves Love, actually.
Yeah. Well, their Forever Love album is a fantastic album.
Yeah, Forever Changes or whatever.
Yeah, I used that through the first Furry Lint.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a second one. We have the we found the inventory for the second one. So Greg Duffel has it somewhere, so I hope to put up the second Furry Lint, which opens with me a private tape of me and Beater talking about our gold deal, which is pretty amazing. But the I just realized now, here's the Moore's Anachrony. So I watched Buffalo 66, and you have the Scott Norwood thing. That's pretty amazing. Then I get Brown Bunny. And Brown Bunny is all about him dealing with the ghost of his girlfriend. And I watch it on the week that Ion is talking a lot about ghosts. So, right, it's just like Fringe, that series. It always has things on its show, even though it was taped, you know, weeks, months before, that relate to what I'm doing with Ion that week. That's what's incredible. Like last week they started up the Fringe series again, and they had two shows, and they played one from the first season, which didn't get played the first season, and then they played a new one from the second season. So two shows. Well, the first show from the first season was all about exorcism, and there has not been a Fringe for a month or so up to this point, and Fringe was always having content that jived with whatever topics Ion and I and Carolyn were doing. Well, over this month hiatus when Fringe wasn't on through December and into January, we have been doing a lot on exorcism.
Right.
So they take the first show back in the winter season. They get a show they didn't broadcast, and it's all about exorcism. So they couldn't play it a year ago because I hadn't been doing Ion's exorcism from Ion's point of view. They have to wait till Bob's watching it, and then they put it on. so he can have his anachrony. Now, be amazed at that.
Yeah.
Which, of course, doesn't make any sense logically. It only makes sense if you think of it in some cosmic synchronistic terms.
Yeah, in the way time, like time doesn't
exist.
Because
nobody was making any decisions, you know, on that level.
That's right. No, but Ion, Ion says there's no linear time, and it's just frequency. And so something, and it didn't even happen in a regular time. It happened when I synced up with Exorcism, then that sucked the fucking show that wasn't broadcast out of the archive, and they played it at the same time I'm doing it with Ion. You know what I mean? It's a frequency tuning.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bob, is it ESP when I... This does happen a fair bit, I swear, when I'm like, I'm thinking of some artist or I'm even thinking of some song, and then like 10 minutes later I step into my car to go somewhere and I turn on the radio and there it is. It's really bizarre. I mean, it doesn't happen like every day, but it happens like often. It's stuff like that, and Neufeld tells me he gets that a lot too, where it's like you're thinking of some specific thing and then it just kind of appears. And while you're thinking of it, you're not thinking, oh, I bet if I turn on the radio, I'm going to hear that.
It's right.
Just, no, you're just thinking of it, and then it's there.
Okay, so first of all, a lot of people report that. But
right.
It's the fact that your experience of your TV body is recycling a lot. There's a chance for that song to be on or some other song you're thinking of because there's so much broadcasting going on. So that's the practical scientific way of looking of the coincidence factor.
Yeah.
But the Ion would say that since there's no time, you actually are thinking of it because you're tuning into an experience you're going to have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're already experiencing it on the no time level. So it's something about... You're thinking of the song, and when you're thinking of the song, you're actually experiencing what happens when you step in the car. But you have to sort out your stacked up nows, is what Ion calls it, so that you allow the time for you to step into the car to hear it. But it's already been happening.
Right, okay.
So it's some kind of frequency alignment, as Ion says, you align up with it. So that's another way.
Yeah, I think there's an alignment between your thinking mind or your thinking body and your feeling or emotional body, because when you tune into a song, you're tuning into some level of feeling or emotion within yourself. And I've noticed that I have also will tend to have like a deja vu or precognitive kind of thing if something is if something's about to happen in my life that is going to have an emotional impact. That emotional component has to be part of it for the sort of precognitive experience to occur.
Yeah, that you're
it has to it, 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 you know it, there's some resonance going on in that with my feeling and thinking body. So anyway, for what it's worth.
Yeah, you have to stop thinking linearly. All your life is happening now. Everything that could or would or did happen. It's all happening now. You just decide that it's like your life is a dial on the radio, and you dial into this, and then you dial into that. Like Scott dialed into me in 99, and then 10 years later dialed into me again.
Yeah.
And so if it's emotionally identified, that's something that's going on in your life that has a conscious impinging on yourself. You're aware of it. So that means you tune in the song that aligns with that.
Hey guys, hold the line a second. You can keep talking. I just got to
Okay. You get that, Scott?
Yeah. So this is kind of fun to watch, this video thing.
Yeah, no, it's a...
So Scott's in here a lot. Everybody's in here. Who's the guy singing in the middle?
Dave's friend, Chuck.
Oh, okay. So, but all three of them are singing. So I guess Scott's doing a little backups.
Yep.
So how long ago was this made?
Oh, 22 years ago, about.
Oh, okay.
22?
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Scott Norwood, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
Scott Norwood. So did you listen to I should send you. I'm sending. You know, I sent out the little my little excerpt.
Yeah.
Ion altering the airwaves in December. Did you listen to that?
Yeah, I did.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's unusual. It's not just your normal kind of static or interruption that you get. It was very.
Talking about this distortion, which I should send you this, Scott Woods. When on December 16th, Ion at the commercial break at the end of the first hour, we're waiting, and Ion starts playing with the broadcast, altering it. Now James and Bill, the owner or engineer of the station, they can't hear because they're hearing within the studio. They're not hearing what people are getting through the internet.
Okay.
But Carol and I, even though we're on the phone, I talked to Bill later about it, we are several layers of the onion out. So we get to hear what the audience is hearing, even though we're hooked into the show, into the studio like James for the show. But we're kind of inside the studio, but we're not as far in as James is because he hooks in on a separate line on Skype. So anyways, Ion alters this thing, and we could hear it. And you could hear me. I think the line's screwing up. And Carol, I think we're going to have to hang up. So then I say, Ion, I think I'm going to have to hang up and call you back if this keeps up. And Ion says, no, we're doing it. And you hear me laughing when I realize Ion was doing it. And then Ion begins to do it. And when James comes on, he's distorting James. And then when it's time for me to talk, after, you know, James's intro blather, you know, okay, we're back, Dr. Dean, Rob Neverett, and Ion, all that stuff. That's all being distorted, and then right when I have to respond to him, Ion stops it. So I taped all, we had it all on our computer, on our record. If you go to Achieve Radio and listen to the archive, you won't hear this, because that's taken off the board, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So I put together, and we're going to play it on Wednesday and show the people, because it happened again last Wednesday. And this time, a listener emailed in and said she heard it. So that proved that it was happening for the audience. So,
at least one person out there.
Yeah, as well as me and Carolyn. So I have that one to do later. I've done that one. I have a second one. Okay, so the thing is, so you're going to hear it on Wednesday, but I can send it to you privately, Scott Woods.
I'd like to hear that.
It's pretty interesting. Now, why are we talking?
It's the weirdest radio interference I've ever heard. It is weird.
Wow.
Okay, here's Neufeld's response. So I sent it out earlier today, and Neufeld says, I love it. Music is Ion's favorite form of time. That's a pretty interesting statement.
Could he hear it as a musical interruption?
I don't know what he means. I mean, he's heard enough Ion to know, I think, that Ion says TikTok time is not where it's at. Timing is where it's at, and that's more musical, timing. That's the tactile ear.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he's referring to Ion's ideology or what, because music is part of, like, he alters the guitar Zappa stuff as we come into James talking, as we come out of the commercials. So he does alter the music, and it's just an interesting statement. It's a learned statement by Dave. Music is Ion's favorite form of time. Okay, then from another guy, someone I know well's had private readings with Ion, he says, hey, Bob, responding to this little 4 minute, 9 second sound thing. I've been around and he's a digital guy, works with computers, and, you know, professionally. I've been around all kinds of computers and communications technologies my whole life, and I have never heard any interference like what is in this audio sample. So he's saying it sounds different.
Yeah, I haven't either.
Yeah, then he says, it does, however, remind me of a perceptual state I encountered in a few psychedelic-induced experiences, a sort of oscillating between information and no information. And then he says, and perhaps more interesting, the timing of the oscillation in your sample matches the timing of low theta waves, which is what Ion says JW experiences in trance.
Hmm.
So that's a good response.
Yeah.
So people are agreeing that there's something different about it.
Yeah, there is, but there's always some. There's always an. You know, I'm the eternal doubter, and there's always some ambiguity because Ion claimed that James and everybody could hear it, and then we found out that they couldn't.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you say, well, is he just taking credit for something after the fact? You know, I mean, could Ion... Well, I'd like Ion to say, okay, we're going to do this for 30 seconds starting in 5 seconds, and then do it, and then stop it, you know? And then we go, well, he did it. But he claims these things after the fact that he's doing it.
No, he claims it while it was happening. Which
oh,
is,
yeah, well...
It was, but here, but here's the thing, is that he would... I don't know if Ion would know whether Bill and James are able to hear it or not. Here's what happened. You can hear me talking to Ion. I said, is this just for me and Carolyn? Because I've had some private communications with Ion this electronically. I get emails from, so I don't know how real all this is. So, is this just me and Carolyn getting it? He said, no, everybody's getting it. And then I said, is Bill and James getting it? And he says, well, I hope so, or something like that.
Yeah, you're right. He goes, yeah, probably, he says,
yeah,
or something
says,
like that.
Probably. And I'm saying, well, we don't want, I don't know if I said it then, but I was thinking, we don't want Bill hearing this because we're fucking with the commercials. And the people paid to have their shit commercialized, you know, played.
Right.
Yeah. They don't want to have it distorted, and it's blatant distortion. But I don't think I understood that part.
Oh, that's why the MP3 people don't hear, oh. No, maybe, I don't know. See, it didn't get recorded, it did not get recorded on the MP3, and maybe it's because it was happening to you guys while they were playing the commercial, and it wasn't happening to the commercial, but it was happening on your phone line or something.
Yeah, no, I eventually called up Bill, and he explained it. He says it's logical. He understands why he and James didn't get it, because they're in board. They're not getting what we hear in the computer. They're getting the pure original signal.
Oh, yeah.
And then Bill described that where Carol and I were, we're on a line that goes bounces over to the server and then to the internet. And he described the two stages that it goes from the studio to our phone,
right,
which is the same as any listener. We're out there, further out than James and Bill. So that's why we could hear it and they couldn't. But Bill thought it was logical. Okay, so. So here's what happened. So Ion does that whole thing, and then it's very interesting. He comes on after and explains what he did. And then nothing happens until January 13th, where at the break, I start hearing this strange static. And this time I'm ready. I go, is that you, Ion? He goes, yes.
Wow.
And so then he plays with the static, and then Bill comes on to do a commercial, and I notice he doesn't alter Bill. As soon as Bill's finished, the static comes back in, and then the Zappa thing comes on, and he super jams the Zappa, and I say, hey, stop that, Ion. I want to hear the Zappa. And Ion kind of laughs and just keeps drowns out all the Zappa. And then James comes on, and James is talking. He does a little static on James, and then right when it's time for us to talk, the static stops. Now, that's not natural. If it's actually fucking happening naturally, then you couldn't have stopped it at that moment.
Wow.
And then Ion comes on and explains it all, and I'm trying to explain to James, and I say, hey, James, did you hear that static? And then Ion goes, and I said, there it is, there, right there, James. Did you hear that? No, I didn't hear. Ion supplemented my explanation of it right when I was talking. Right when I said, did you hear that static, James? There it is, James. You hear that? No, Bob, I don't hear it. Okay, so that all happened, and he might have did it one more time, and then that's it. We do the second hour, and then right at the end, as James is signing off and he comes into Shania Twain, Ion starts zapping the Shania Twain thing. Comes right back in, right on cue, and he does it for a while, and then the song fades out or we get disconnected. Okay, before Wednesday's show, I call up Bill, and I call up just before it starts, and he says, we're having trouble with James's Skype. I don't know if we're going to be able to do this. And then within a minute, it was fixed. Okay, so that happened. And then after the show, we always talk. James gets a private session, in a way, with Ion, because Ion stays on the line. James disconnects from Bill. Then I call him, and then we talk about the show with Ion for about an hour. So we go into a lot of different things on that. So and Eben gets the same little perk, you know. They get to talk to Ion about whatever. So... in the course of talking, in the hour after the show, Ion suddenly says, "Bob, you notice James had a little trouble with his Skype?" And Well, I got this wrong. This was not said to me when we were talking to James. That night, when I was in a private, when I was having a private session with IAM, IAM brings up, remember when you're having trouble with Skype? Or James was, and I said, yeah. He says, well, what did we talk about the night before? And he's referring to melting titanium, which now, Scott, is up to 2 and 3 hours long. We just go on forever.
Wow.
The ESP show. But anyways, he says, what did we talk about? And I said, well, you asked me if I was looking forward to the show. And I answered, yes. And we discussed about what kind of anticipation you have for the show that was coming up the next day. Okay, so he reminds me that's what we discussed Tuesday night. And he said, I set you up, Ian says to me, I set you up, Bob, because here you are ready for the show, all excited, and the Skype breaks. And you start saying, oh, we're not even going to get to do the show. And I said, oh, so you did the Skype break just to bug me. And Ian said, yes. And then I told James that later, and he couldn't believe it. But he's beginning to believe it now. But what do you think of that? He could fuck with the Skype. He could fuck with anything. Now, that's Fate magazine material. That's stuff for Amazing Randy to come in and bring his laboratory scientists in. Well, okay, we're going to get the bottom of this, right?
Yeah, but it'll never happen because it's like the UFO. The people who've experienced the UFO apparently cannot deny that something happened. You bring in the scientists and you try to get some consensus reality on what's happening, and it always turns into an ambiguous situation, and it's never provable.
That's right. So I was telling Greg Duffel at CKLM about this, and he's a pretty, you know, atheist guy. He's a Stalinist, and he says, there's no fucking way Iron was doing that. And I said, I think he was, Greg. No, no. And so he's proposed this. He says, the only way you can prove it to me, Bob, is that you're doing a show, and all of a sudden you spring in unannounced on Ion. Ion, alter the signal. With no preparation.
Right.
And if Ion did it, that would blow Greg away. But that's what Greg requires. And I don't know whether to do it because it would... and I can't tell James or anybody that I'm going to do it. There's no preparation. You've got to spring on him. And, you know, Ion might not do it, and then it blows it. But so I don't know. I'm wondering whether to spring it. So I decided to tape it, or excerpt the tape. We're going to play it tomorrow, and we'll see... Maybe that'll get Ion in the mood to give a new example, a new sample. So we'll see, but it is always ambivalent. It's always, which is a chicken. But it's pretty obvious that when you listen to the second version, that the thing that happened last Wednesday, it is obviously, it's just static, but it... And then you see Ion is pulsing the static in between the beats of the commercial, the speech, or the music. It's obviously orchestrated.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Well, go on. I'm going to go on for a second because I'm going to do something here.
Yeah, it's obviously orchestrated as much as we could understand anything. Now, what was it? I get emails from Ion, right? Scott Woods, you know about that.
No, I don't know about that.
Yeah, and there's no evidence. I get them with JW's signature on them, his email signature, but there's no record in his computer that he sent it to me. And so me and Carolyn get the Ion email. I just got one today. Yahoo News. He sends me Yahoo News stories. Bible probably written centuries earlier. And Ion says in his little message, he says, even the Time Lords, which is referring to Doctor Who, I think, even the Time Lords are not sure about this time business. This is interesting, is it not? So we'll probably talk about it.
But you're saying he's not typing through JW's fingers. He's just sending this to you without using a keyboard.
That's right, and it's he's just manifesting it.
Let me play this audio clip for...
Just let me finish the story. So he's sending emails to us, so when we get good ones... we say, JW, did you get one? No. So we have to send what Ion sends us back to JW. And I assume JW is telling the truth. He is. There's no record of them coming out of his computer, even though they have his signature on it. So I asked Ion to explain this, and he spent a while, months ago, explaining the physics of how Ion can do this. And I don't know if I understood it. So after last week, I did another session and asked Ion to explain it, and he described it this way. Because Ion says that they're non-physical, they do not create anything. We create everything here. They cannot create. But they can know everything that's going on here. So I said, well, how do you affect the electrical signals? He says, it's like creating a vacuum or like drawing air. He says, a chimney is a good example. The smoke goes up the chimney because the fire creates a vacuum and then it sucks it up, right? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of physics. He used the phrase, we create a vacuum and then the thing rushes through. That's what ion does. He can massage the electric signals and like create a vacuum and then reorganize it.
But you know what, Bob? Your computer cannot process that email unless it has a source IP and a destination IP. I'd like to know what the source IP address is. And
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You want me to forward it to you? Can you figure it out?
I might be able to, yeah. Let me play the audio clip for Scott that you sent last week's sample from Cash. This is what happened while the commercial break was happening, right, Bob, on Cash Flow?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on.
We're giving you an example of time, and what he was saying, what he was showing, is that with our concept of linear time, we're actually imposing that effect on reality, and Ian goes on to say it's very annoying to us. We're experiencing, one, two, three, tick, tick, tick. And then you hear Ian go, did you hear him go, left, right, left, the march of time, left, right. Did you hear that, Scott?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could hear him say something like that, yeah.
Yeah, laugh, right, and then I start laughing. And it even gets better. It gets really good. It goes on for 4 minutes.
That's just, truly bizarre.
Yeah, continue playing it, Scott.
For the whole 4 minutes or just another minute?
Yeah, heck of the whole experience.
All right.
Corrupt your wonderful It's aggravating. It's confusing. It perplexes you. You want it to stop. Well, we do too.
So did
right.
Did you? You didn't hear that, did you, James?
No, everything sounds like normal over here.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So I just did it to us.
All right.
No. Everybody's on. It's everyone heard it.
Bill heard it. Bill's running around trying to figure out how to fix it.
Or not. I don't know. He would have sent me a flash message if there was something going on with that. But maybe he'll tell me at the end of the hour here.
Okay. So we don't know.
I just got a message. You said all normal here.
Yes.
Good.
Okay. So that was just for what was interesting is Ion did make it happen for Carol and I and then stopped it. That's what's interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if there were parallel worlds, this idea, then I had the experience, and then I run to the dictionary or my medical book and say, okay.
And then that's the end of the sample. So isn't that incredible? You see here, Ion comes on and imitates it exactly the same way.
Yeah, it's totally bizarre.
It's totally real. That's what's going on here.
Man.
So I can send you that. You can send it around to your friends.
Yeah, I want to hear that. Yeah, I want to hear it again, yeah.
And then, okay, so what are we doing here? There was another story I wanted to tell you. I did the Brown Bunny and how that synced up with topics that we're doing with Ion the past few weeks, and then I watched it and it synced up. And so the two movies, they dealt with the second movie, Brown Bunny, dealt with my Ion experience with ghosts and all that, and the other Gallo movie, Buffalo 66, related to the other thing I'm doing, which is with you, with Scott Woods doing this music thing.
Yeah.
Scott Norwood.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think we should start, eh?
Yeah, probably. This might be a bit of a shorter. I know I say that every time, but I really...
Yeah, you'll get killed again. You'll go on for 5 hours. You'll get so carried away.
Oh, man, I can't do it.
Well, how did you do last week? You went way over. Did you survive?
Oh, I survived, but yeah.
You hate it, though. Yeah, the morning, oh, shit, I need more sleep.
I mean, I like it, you know, for the next day, because I'm thinking about it a lot and stuff, but I mean, I'm just like, it's catching up to me, this stuff, because I've just kind of got a lot on my plate right now, so. But no, like, it's fun. So.
Yeah, so let's try, we'll try what we can. So I'm just going to go clear my throat, and then we can, what is it, it's January 18th, number 8?
Yeah, number 8. I'm actually behind on posting the last. I'm going to post 2 together on that.
Okay. Here, just a second.
So, Scott, this the first, last, and everything, was that your big 15 minutes of fame, or have you had other gigs like that where sort of multimedia gigs you've been involved in?
I don't know. I mean, I've done lots of stuff over the years, but I mean, I think that's still maybe the only time I've been on TV. I've got a book out that I co-wrote a book after that with a friend of mine. And we got on the media in Toronto quite a bit, or in Canada, and that sort of thing. So I've sort of like had a 2-minute bit of fame here, a 2-minute bit of fame there. I haven't really achieved the 15 minutes in full yet. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I mean, no, to be honest with you, too, that Catch-22 thing was like, it really didn't, like, the single, I think, sold okay, like, from Dave's perspective or from the label's perspective, but it wasn't, like, we weren't a real band. It didn't really resonate in that way at all. Like, we never did anything beyond that one. Like, Dave made the entire record by himself, basically, with that singer, and then we did that performance. I was just like, you know, a showroom dummy kind of thing.
Well, you're playing keyboards and singing backup vocals, right?
No, but I'm pretending. Vanilla.
Oh, it's lip syncing.
It's total lip syncing. That's why I said it was funny, because if you actually like listen fairly closely to the track, my hands in one scene are not doing at all what's actually coming out. Like I'm hitting, like it looks really bad. I'm hitting like 3 notes at once, kind of thing. Like,
yeah, I saw that, but I wasn't listening to the music.
Hysterical,
oh, that's funny. you didn't even get any...
That was a blip.
You didn't even get any groupies out of this gig?
No, God.
So, but the dancers, these are not random people off the street. They brought them in because they were dancers?
Yeah, well, a couple of those, there was actually, I think, two people actually specifically sort of dancing with it. Was it two people in that clip dancing sort of on the stage or something?
Well, no, there's a whole floor full of people. And,
right, but I think there's two people who are kind of like almost with the band, like, they're sort of at the front of the stage. Like, I think it's like a sort of short Asian guy and this black girl.
Right, yeah, they get the solo gig, the solo performance.
We brought them with us, actually. They were both, Dave and I used to DJ at the same club in Toronto, and they were just like kids that would kind of hang out at this club, and, you know, they could dance sort of thing. So, you know, Dave approached and said, hey, we're going to be on Electric Circus. You want to come on? You want to be our dancer, kind of thing, and you know they were totally into it. So
yeah, and part of the appeal of the show was that it had the ethnic bias.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. City TV in Toronto was like, you know, pushing the multicultural thing like eons ago. It was like, oh yeah, I mean, the host on that show was like an Indian woman. Yeah, the audience would be totally mixed, and probably like, you know, pushing quite sort of heavily, though still not, you know, not in a specifically spoken kind of way, like definitely like, you know, the gay sort of thing as well. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It'd be pretty obvious, like they, you know, they'd happily have sort of, you know, men sort of dancing around in such a way that just this guy looks like he's dressed like he, you know, hangs out at a gay bar or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. I mean, it was totally, you know, anything and everything goes sort of thing.
And this was like in the late 80s or something?
Yeah, that's around 88, 89.
Yeah, and see, Moses Neimer even got written up in Time magazine in the early 70s. You know the movie Videodrome?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Videodrome by, what's his name? Who made it?
Cronenberg
is pissed at Moses Neimer, the guy who created the station that Dave and Scott are on. And so Videodrome was about a maniac who runs a TV station, one of the characters. I think Debbie Harry works for him. That's based on Moses Neimer, and he broke on the scene in the early 70s by offering porn on TV in staid Puritan Toronto.
That's right, yeah.
And so he got money doing that, and then he just started playing movies and expanded, and he's a cultural icon in Toronto.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And he could, so that's City TV. It was probably the most, he did, you might have seen it in some American TV. Remember he did that interview series? He interviewed all these famous people?
That's right, yeah.
And he's an asshole himself, you know, he's a pompous jerk. And, but he would think that he applied McLuhan to, in the content world. He high took the new medium, bypassed the literate establishment of Toronto, and created a whole empire.
Yeah, I saw him on TV once actually talking about McLuhan, and so he was obviously, you know, sort of tuned into it or whatever.
Yeah, no, he may have been a student of Thiel's at McGill.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I think he grew
Cronenberg
up...
Cronenberg obviously is a McLuhan.
Yeah.
McLuhanite too.
It's interesting, he may not get it, but he does it. He's sort of wrestling with the themes, whether he knows it or not.
Yeah, I would think to some degree he knows it, but
yeah, he's,
I think he's pretty self-conscious about it, I think, Cronenberg.
Yeah, well, there's a book, Cronenberg on Cronenberg, and I looked at some of it, and I don't think I saw him McLuhan mentioned.
Really? That's interesting. I thought I'd seen him mention him a few times, but I could be wrong. I could be mixing up with William Gibson or something.
Well, when he made Scanner, Videodrome, a lot of people knew it referred to McLuhan, so it would have come up in his interviews, but I just don't see a record. If you can, I mean, let me just Google Cronenberg McLuhan.
Yeah.
And see if anything comes up. But I was not too impressed with what he was saying in the interview. It wasn't that interesting, you know. He's just a technical guy.
But see, filmmakers kind of work at that unconscious level, right?
Yeah,
I think the best of them. They can't sort of do what you do. They can't explain. I don't know if you think David. I know you talk a lot about David Lynch. I don't know if he's. I mean, I would assume he's kind of the same. I mean, in interviews, he just kind of almost talks like a lot of silly talk. Like, it's interesting. You can read a lot into it. But I don't think, does he really kind of explain, is he able to explain what he's actually doing?
No. It says there's a lot on people connecting Cronenberg and McLuhan, and it's, I have a quote here, sounds too McLuhan to you, challenge Cronenberg as I attempted to sort out Videodrome's cluttered iconology during 1983. Let's just see what this is. Okay. Yeah, he's talking, somebody's writing, understand that Videodrome was released 16 years prior to The Matrix. Then the critic says, sounds, then he quotes Cronenberg, sounds too McLuhan to you, challenge Cronenberg, as I attempted to sort out Videodrome's cluttered iconology during a 1983 interview. And then Cronenberg says, well, you know, McLuhan was from Toronto, notes the director of The Media Theorist, who said, notes the director of The Media Theorist, McLuhan, who said the medium is the message. And then in brackets, as to whether there's something intrinsically Torontonian in Marshall McLuhan's and Cronenberg's vision of life mediated by media, it's worth mentioning that the Canadian director Adam McGoyan is likewise obsessed. But that's another essay. So, Cronenberg did mention McLuhan.
Hmm.
But he's probably saying to some American who doesn't understand McLuhan. I mean, so that's... He's almost like speaking as a Canadian when he says, sounds too McLuhan to you, says Cronenberg, you know?
Yeah. This hey, Bob, what do you think of the guy, not to keep going on these tangents, what do you think of the writer... the guy's book, I think I've got his name, B.F. Powell or something like that, or B.F.
Oh, Bruce right. Powell, yeah, no, I know Bruce well.
I like his book. I've got his book on McLuhan and Lewis. And
yeah, Solitary Outlaw.
Yeah.
You know who liked that book?
Who?
Clinton.
Really, eh?
Yeah, Bruce was probably born in early 50s, 55 or so, but his letters... were given to York University, and he gave them his letters from Clinton. Clinton showed up in the early 90s or somewhere.
Wow.
He showed up at the Canadian Embassy party, some party at the Canadian Embassy, and he went around asking, did anybody know who Bruce Powell was? And nobody knew who Bruce was.
Really?
Yeah, and he was trying to find someone to, because Clinton wanted to talk to him. And so there's some correspondence between Bruce and Clinton that's in the University archives.
Oh, that's cool. Huh.
And, you know, Bruce is the literary. See, he scored.
Very literary, yeah.
Yeah, he's the guy who scored by interviewing, getting an interview with Trudeau after. That book, Solitary Outlaw, comes out in 87. And he got an interview with Trudeau, but that's because his father was a biggie in the Liberal Party, and so he knew Trudeau. And Trudeau wasn't talking to the media, but he agreed to speak to Bruce. So that, you know, within the incestuous Toronto media scene, that was a big deal that Bruce got to talk to Trudeau.
His entry, yeah.
Yeah, and I knew Bruce in the late 70s when he was a student at McLuhan's, and he would come to the Monday night seminars. And Bruce, over the last 5 years, Bruce finds me the only guy that he can talk about this shit, because he got a gig at York, and he's working on his PhD, and he got that, but he was using McLuhan, and it got him in a lot of trouble, as it always does. And then he actually got a McLuhan Center going. He got Mrs. McLuhan's approval. And they have a site, but not much is happening. And he's getting hassled by the director of the English department. And for the last 3 years, we've been confiding, or he confides in me what goes on, because I'm the only one who can sort of understand what he's doing.
Yeah, really. So you have some correspondence with him, or you talk to him?
On the phone. I send out emails, like Scott gets them. Scott Norris, and I get about 112 people that are on my list, and I send all my little inside notices, and Bruce is on the list.
Huh.
And, but Bruce is, I know all of them, like Frank Sangroni just died.
Yeah, yeah.
And Frank Sangroni got Bruce Powell a gig at York back in the 80s. See, Bruce got in there and was able to teach courses, and he was the first to do one at Northrop Frye and McLuhan, but he didn't have a PhD in the stupid pecking order of the department. He was an outsider. And then he pulled off this McLuhan thing with Mrs. McLuhan, so and he was a bit of a novelist. He was a known novelist. He did that book. He did a good book on Canada, A Tremendous Country of Light. Have you seen that book?
Yeah, I want to get that. Actually.
You know, Bruce is a good writer. And he's sort of aware of at least the analog media effect. And But what was I going to say? So basically, there's not anybody in that close circle of people who were students of McLuhan that were involved with McLuhan that I don't know, and I'm usually respected by them. Because they know I know more than them.
Yeah.
So, of course, Bruce, I mean, it got lonely for him. He had no one to talk to. And then I showed up in 2007 and met with him. And then I went out to his class, and he had he inaugurated his new series with, who's the famous Canadian composer, Murray, does the radio classical music works, Murray Schamberg, Murray Schaefer.
Schaefer, okay.
Yeah, and it was at that seminar, which was really good, that I got him, Murray, to talk about. He sat in a McLuhan's classes in the early 50s, and we get this anecdote that none of us knew. Murray said that Marshall would arrange his classes. Everybody sat in chairs in a circle with him sitting in the middle of the circle on a swivel chair so he could swivel around and look at anybody. And Murray said, but the mind-blowing thing for him was when McLuhan held up Finnegan's Wake and said, this is not a book, it's a radio program. And that became the eureka that turned Murray into a major composer in Canada.
Wow.
So Bruce had him at his inaugural seminar. He's had stuff. You can get to the website. There should be video. You can see Eric did a talk there. But Eric, you can't get anything out of Eric. You know, Eric should be me, but he isn't. So I'm the guy who has to do all the talking with people.
Why can't you get anything out of him? Because he's very guarded about it.
Yeah, he's guarded and stick of the mud, and he's just not very gregarious about McLuhan stuff.
Yeah.
He's paranoid. Hmm. He likes to keep it to himself. He doesn't. That's what people do. They go interview Eric, and then they'll play it to me, and I'll fill in all the stuff Eric didn't tell them.
Yeah. Amazing.
Does Eric have a grievance with you, Bob, for...
Big grievance.
that you get it more than he does?
Well, I there's different grievances. He lies about me and all kinds of crap, because he puts me in with Nelson. But I asked Ian a few months ago, but what's with Eric? And he said, well, basically, Eric's jealous of you, Bob, because he says, why is everybody listening to him? Why aren't they talking to me? And, like, I'm not out, you know, on Crossfire or Charlie Rose, but Eric in his little world thinks because there's YouTube's made or I'm on some fringe radio network talking about McLuhan, he thinks that I'm getting notice and he isn't.
Yeah.
I mean, he might hear about you talking to me, and you say, well, geez, why doesn't he interview me? Nobody's listening to this shit, you know? It's great shit, but not many people right now are listening. They might someday once me and I unlock down Bob Rules, and everybody will be listening to this stuff, right?
Yeah.
But Eric is ridiculous. He thinks the claim that I'm getting all the attention he isn't is stupid. I'm not getting any attention from where he would like to get attention. He could get the attention, just make himself available. Call up Charlie Rose, he could get on.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, one thing I miss about your show on James Martinez, I got to say, is I wish you were doing a show with someone else that would fill this gap where you used to kind of like you talk about the the news of the week or something. Like,
I know that's what Jim Patterson says. I mean, and Terry, the guy. Everybody misses Bob. You're better than I are.
because like I was just looking at something on the internet right now about the whole like Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien sort of, you know, frack, like all like TV's kind of going like insane right now. I was like wondering what would Bob say about
Well, why don't we do it?
We
can do the Jeffrey O'Brien and then at some point do what you want to talk about today and then I'll do it. I just have to have someone to talk to about it. That's a radio show for me.
Okay.
So we'll do it.
I don't know if we'll get to specifically this show.
Yeah, no, but think about it. You can do it. I mean, the thing is that I've been doing that for 25 years, giving interesting patterns about what's going on.
Yeah.
But we're at a new point, and I don't mind letting Ion verbally run the show because Ion has a lot of interesting things to say, and I think that's the Astrobody's view, and I want to bring it in.
Yeah, okay.
So, everybody misses Bob, but you can get Bob on Ben or with you.
Okay, that's cool. I haven't even heard the last Ben show, actually. Did you
right.
Miss a week, though, or something?
Last week, Ben couldn't do it. He was just too beat.
He had the Scott Woods syndrome, you know, too many babies and family, and just couldn't do it. We're going to call it the Scott Woods or Ben Watson syndrome, the early father with young babies.
That's funny.
Yeah, but no, I've thought about it. I know Jim Patterson's complained, like, you know, he says, you're better than I am. Well, yeah, okay, we could be making patterns. See, this is the point. You guys need to have your patterns for your chip body and your TV body because that's one of your bodies. And that's more pressing, you know, about Jay Leno, which is a bunch of shit, Jay Leno and all that, but it's pressing on you in a media world, and you guys don't have time for the astral body. But I'm saying, fuck you. I'm hiking up the astral body for a while.
No, I understand. Yeah.
You know, you got to, I'm bringing in that part with ion, which is the perfect solution, and bringing, because I say you have to juggle your four bodies, so we got to juggle the astral body.
Yeah, well, and my making that point, though, is not saying I'm not dismissing, you know, the ion astral body.
But you just missed, I mean, it's in some way, what I think I contribute to the ion thing is I come up with good questions and keep it going.
Yeah.
So that's my right. I don't mind doing that. But those that like my pattern recognition, they're going to miss it.
Yeah.
But what's great is that's why it's great you came along. I mean, because we got Ben, but that's dominated by Ben, so it doesn't work as well there. But with you, I get to dominate, so then you can get all the patterns. So, and what's great, we're doing history. So there's lots of Bob provided through the other shows.
Yeah. No, that's true.
So you can say, that's what I said last week. We should be Android Meme Critic. Not just so we're Rock Critic. We're doing that historically, almost scholarly. But we can do AndroidMemeCritics.com with talking about whatever's going on.
Yeah. Okay, no, that's cool.
Okay. So, so the pressure's off. You say, Bob, I haven't done any research on the Rock Critic, so I don't have to do any research in fucking Android Meme because it's all around me in Toronto Sun headlines every day. So. Okay, so, Scott, are you ready? I think I need to spit up again, but you can start January 18th, number 8. Are you ready, Scott North?
Yeah.